you for coming along this morning. My name's Greg Lyon. I'm a former chair of Green's List and one of the criminal silks practising on the list. The topic this morning revolves around drug trials and drug matters. Our first speaker is Justin Hanabry, who many of you know. His paper today is going to be absolutely terrific, and we know that because it's so good he's got his dad and his brother here. Justin is one of the senior juniors practising in crime on our list, and you can see from his CV he has experience. His practice these days is principally evolving into the Supreme Court, where he undertakes murder trials. He has appeared in the Court of Appeal on a number of occasions. He has a substantial confiscation practice, which has devolved from his drug work. So Justin is well qualified to speak about his approach and to share his wisdom with you on matters to take into account in running drug trials. Our second speaker today is Frank Scully, who, although he's only been at the bar a couple of years now, is still well qualified to speak to you about drug matters from a summary aspect. Frank was a member of Victoria Police for many years and a prosecutor for 13 years. As a senior prosecutor, he appeared in a number of matters and performed roles in coronial inquests and police tort matters as a senior sergeant in the Civil Litigation Division. So Frank will follow up with another unique perspective after Justin, but can I welcome Justin to the lectern?
Morning, everyone. Thanks for coming along to this, the most sought after of CLE spots, 7:30 on a winter's morning. The topic today is about drug trials, and it's always topical, but especially topical at the moment because we've had one of our intermittent revivals of debate about drug law and drug law reform. And the way in which these matters usually play out seems to be the way it's playing out this time as well, namely someone, let's call them university lecturer, drug law expert, criminologist, somebody of that nature, makes a comment indicating that maybe the path we're going down isn't the right one and that maybe some level of decriminalisation is the way to go. Cue politician comes in, feigns outrage. A few months later, we end up with some tweak on our existing drug laws under the premise that it makes it tougher on crime and that it's these drug laws that are actually going to deter everyone, and that this time they've invoked laws that will mean that it'll be harder to beat charges, that people get longer jail sentences, all things of that nature. Now, the history of our laws evolving in this way has led us to the point we're at now. I think it's worth reflecting a bit as to exactly where we're at the moment with our drug laws, because they do create some somewhat counterintuitive opportunities now when you are dealing with a client charged with drug offences to assist, to perhaps even run trials, where you might think there isn't any real basis to dispute terribly much at all. Now, I'll give you a fictional but very common example, a sort of thing that you might see before the courts every day. Situation where the police, acting on information received, do a raid on a property. Inside that property, they find a sophisticated hydroponic setup. They find documentation showing that your client is the person who's rented that property. They find an electricity bypass. They find 40 nearly mature female cannabis plants. They weigh them. They weigh 120 kilos. 70 kilos of that is leaves and flowering heads. And the botanist, extremely well qualified and extremely truthful witness, says that when you dry all that out, it would come out to about 20 kilos. The police also find your client. They peel him off the vinyl couch. They pull the bong out of his hand, pull the PlayStation remote control out of his other hand, and he's really got not much to say, and he makes a no comment record of interview. Now, following this whole incident, he's charged with trafficking in a commercial quantity of cannabis based on being in possession of that weight of cannabis clearly for the purposes of sale, given the nature of the setup, and also cultivation in a commercial quantity of cannabis based upon the weight of the plants. Now think for a moment how a regular person in the street might think of that situation. They might think this bloke has really got not much to say about anything, and that really the only possible hurdles to a pretty swift conviction and a pretty swift sentence being imposed are some sort of bizarre quirk, like a corrupt police officer, some sort of messed up warrant, something of that nature. But even in those circumstances, you might think that a judge is going to be well capable of overcoming any little flaws to get to the real justice of the situation. The situation we're in at the moment, though, is that on those particular charges, namely trafficking in a commercial quantity or cultivation in a commercial quantity, and despite the fact that in the scenario I've just outlined, you might think there's no dispute about what this person's done, namely grow cannabis, no dispute that it's illegal and that he knew it was illegal, no dispute as to the precise scope of what he's done. He grew plants weighing 120 kilos and there were 40 of them. There's no dispute that the commercial quantity designated for that drug is 25 kilos. And your client's put forward absolutely no positive defence. Now, where we're at the moment is that even in that scenario, there are genuine and live issues for a court to determine. Now, you might think somebody walking in off the street looking at that might think that's a pretty remarkable state of affairs, but that's the state of affairs we've got to. For example, was he in possession of the cannabis? Did he possess it for the purpose of sale? Even if they get over that, what portion of that cannabis did he possess for sale? In relation to the cultivation, did he know that the cannabis, wet, sitting in the ground, weighed more than 25 kilos? If not, was he aware that there was a significant and real chance that the cannabis weighed more than 25 kilos? Now, all those matters are on that, what would seem to be a fairly overwhelming circumstances I've described to you, more than open for debate. And in fact, on some of those questions, you might think the Crown, on the evidence that's available to them, falls somewhat short. What this has been a combined effort of a legislature continuing to tweak laws with a particular intention, combined with the collective willpower of accused and defence lawyers to analyse those laws and to find where the law has been left in terms of the mens rea that's applicable to those offences. And in all this, no doubt the legislature has been an unwitting accomplice. The fact that we're having debates and we're having trials about circumstances as I've described is a direct result of the way the laws have evolved, and I think more than that, behind it, the motivation behind these laws being resolved, the motivation being effectively political, namely be seen to be doing something. And like everything in the law, there's always an unintended consequence. Now, as a practitioner, being aware of precisely where these defences to those charges may lie is going to be extremely important, not just because it's the commercial and large commercial charges that carry the highest maximum penalties, and clearly when you look at the statistics, there's a big difference in what people get when the same set of facts is charged either as trafficking commercial quantity or trafficking simpliciter. The other issue too is that the legislature's also made some very direct connections between conviction upon commercial quantity offences and automatic forfeiture provisions under the Confiscation Act. So what my paper's about today is really examining where those defences are and what approach you might take to them. And it is of potential great importance to your client, even in circumstances where their situation might otherwise appear pretty dire, in that it might save them time in jail and, just as importantly to some of them, might save them considerable assets. That's even when they might ultimately be destined to plead guilty or to be found guilty of something in relation to the matter. Now, I've given the breadth of this topic, I don't pretend that these range of observations are anything more than just skimming the surface of a few matters I think that should be borne in mind. But I've tried to cherry pick what I think are a few important matters to be aware of when you're running drug trials and preparing to run drug trials. And part of that, I think, is being aware of the inherent nature of drug trials, because they are somewhat different, I think, from trials where, for example, someone's charged with assault or rape or something like that. In those type of charges, essentially what you're generally dealing with is direct evidence. You're dealing with a witness who's making an accusation against your client, as in, I saw him do this, I heard him say that, full stop, and it's really for the jury or the trier of fact to determine whether they accept that witness's version of events beyond reasonable doubt or not. In relation to drug trials, more often than not, they are essentially, at their core, circumstantial cases. And what I mean by that is that once you go through the process of working out what's admissible and what's not, and once we've got through the stage of working out that, you know, there's no way you can argue out warrants or argue away actions of police, you're essentially left with a set of fixed and indisputable facts. The fact there was a search, the fact they found what they said they found, the fact the drugs were identified as being cannabis, the fact the cannabis was weighed and determined to have the weight that the botanist described. Now, all those matters are not going to be cross-examined away. That's going to be what the jury find to be the facts in the case. What the real issue for the Crown then is whether there's an inference that can be drawn from those facts that supports the supports guilt on the individual charges that have been laid. And if I can add to that, in a criminal trial, because the prosecution have the burden of proof, whether that is the only reasonable inference. Can the Crown, from those set facts, infer guilt to the exclusion of all other reasonable hypotheses? And when I say reasonable hypotheses, I mean reasonable hypotheses consistent with innocence of the individual charge. And that might not mean necessarily innocence in relation to all things. What you need to do is examine the charge that's before the court and see whether the only reasonable inference is one that shows your client to be guilty of that particular charge. Now, can I say quickly, there is, I think, the one main exception to the concept that drug trials are essentially circumstantial cases is when the prosecution choose to rely upon either a co-accused giving evidence or an informer giving evidence. Now, generally speaking, this has turned out not to be a terrible thing for an accused in a trial. It is in some ways a much easier thing to confront one witness and challenge one witness's credit rather than ask the jury to infer something from the set of facts that might seem to avoid the inescapable conclusion from those set of facts. when you are dealing with an informer or a co-accused giving evidence, you know from the very start that at the very least they are criminal accomplices who've got a strong motive to lie about the involvement of others in their offending, and they've got a strong motive to minimise their own involvement. That's a pretty good start if you're going to be contending to a jury that that witness shouldn't be believed. Beyond that, in dealing with a witness of that nature, there are great opportunities in pre-trial discovery and in a committal, if you get the opportunity, to set up the arguments you're going to be making at trial. Now, in my paper, I've given a little list of things that I think really go to the matters that you're going to be looking to when there's an informer giving evidence. And in a broad scope, they're really surrounding the timing of their decision to give evidence. Where were they at in their lives and in their criminal case once they decided to give evidence? Because generally speaking, there's a chronology surrounding it that will tell a story. What situation were they in? Were they in a desperate situation where they were facing jail? Were they in a situation where they perceived that they were facing jail, even if they weren't? Were they in a situation where they perceived the case against them to be overwhelming? The perceived and actual benefits that they have received from giving evidence are matters that you can find out pre-trial. You can find out what charges have been dropped. You can find out what charges proceeded and how a judge dealt with them at court. You can find out what their lawyer said on their behalf in court and how much they relied upon their evidence against their co-accused in mitigation of sentence. You can also find out through the discovery process previous statements that they've made, previous interviews that they've made, notes of conversations with the police, and oftentimes when these are put together in a chronological order, you can see the emergence of a story. You can see the change perhaps from a claim of innocence to a claim that someone else has done something wrong to suddenly really getting on a bandwagon and giving evidence extensively against a lot of people. And they're all matters that can be worked out pre-trial. Now, that's a very distinctive sort of drug trial. What I say, though, is that most of the time you're dealing in that first sort of trial, namely, it's a circumstantial case. What inferences can be drawn from the proven facts? And in that first sort of case, the circumstantial sort of case, you're very rarely dealing with direct evidence from one witness about what your client said or did. Now, the real significance of drug trials being circumstantial cases comes when you consider what the prosecution have to prove in relation to the mental element of the offence. Now, I say this particularly in relation to the mental element of the offence as it applies to commercial quantity and large commercial quantity charges. Now, if you think about it, the prosecution are the ones that carry the burden of proof. In the absence of any direct admissions from your client, basically, they have to infer an intent to cultivate or traffic a commercial or large commercial quantity from the set of facts that the jury find. Now, that has proven to be, in recent years, a difficult task for the prosecution in a number of circumstances. Now, I've given an example here from a case of the Queen and Reed from the Court of Appeal in 2008. Now, that was a case where, except this, there was overwhelming evidence that Mr. Reed was involved in the cultivation of cannabis, 5 plants weighing 26.5 kilos, and that really wasn't in dispute at the trial. What the prosecution were going to have to establish, though, was that the accused knew believed or was aware that there was a significant or real chance that he was cultivating not less than 25 kilos of cannabis. Now, the difficulties faced by the Crown in trying to establish that in a circumstantial case, I think are evident when you look at the very short summary of basically what the defence case was here. And what the Court of Appeal said was this. It should be mentioned that, as his counsel submitted with respect to the inference that the appellant was intentionally complicit in the cultivation of a commercial quantity, these points were mentioned. There were only five plants, weighing just over a commercial quantity, 26.5 kilograms. There was no evidence that the accused knew about the 25 kilo threshold. There was no evidence that the accused was present at the premises when the plants were grown when they weighed in excess of 25 kilos. There were no admissions as to knowledge of the weight of the crop. There was no evidence of the co-accused, Mr. Stevens' intention with respect to quantity or of what the accused believed Mr. Stevens' state of mind to be. Now, the reason I focus on that example is that what it shows there is that that's an argument that's made without challenging a single piece of evidence. That's looking at the set of facts as they exist and saying what it can prove and what it can't prove. When you look at the set of facts as existed in Mr. Reed's case and then compared it with that mental state that the prosecution had to prove, you can see that even in circumstances where an accused involvement in and motivation for cannabis cultivation might be an inescapable conclusion, an overwhelming conclusion from the facts, the evidence might still fall short of excluding as a reasonable possibility that he wasn't aware of the weight of the plants cultivated. You might think that sounds pretty logical. Not many people look at a plant sitting in the ground and necessarily know how much it weighs. Maybe didn't believe they were in excess of 25 kilos or had simply not considered the matter at all. Now, that third element's important as well because it's for the prosecution to establish that an accused person has turned their mind to this issue of weight and then has formed a view that there's a real risk, that it was more real possibility that there was more than 25 kilos. Now, the way the law is at the moment in relation to intent upon that, and really sort of been going this way since Sadelec's case determined that trafficking and trafficking in a commercial quantity were two separate charges carrying two separate criminal intentions, that's a real difficulty for the Crown that they're going to struggle to get over in cases where there is not direct evidence from an accused as to their state of mind at the time. Once they're relying entirely upon inference, even without challenging particular aspects of the evidence, the challenges for the Crown still exist and they can still be exploited. Now, my next point is about how the law now stands since the case of Mustika and the Queen from last year. Now, this is a case that I think has got real challenges posed real challenges both for the Crown and indeed for the defence. Now, what we know is that ever since the case of Giretti and the Queen, the prosecution are entitled to put a trafficking charge on a between dates basis. So where somebody is carrying on the business of trafficking between the 1st of January and the 1st of June, the Crown can say, well, we are putting together all this conduct of you in the business of a drug trafficker between those dates, and we're going to call that one count, and when you get convicted of it, you're going to be sentenced on the basis of all that conduct over that period of time. And that's the way it was for some time. Now, what Mustika's case says is that where someone is in the business of trafficking, they're charged with one of these Giretti-type counts, And the prosecution are alleging that the trafficking has been in a commercial quantity. It's not enough for the prosecution just to be able to prove that, well, at some stage during this 6 months of trafficking, this person became aware that he'd clearly trafficked more than the commercial quantity. That's not good enough anymore. The prosecution now, since Mustika, have to establish that from day one of this business of trafficking, the accused had an intention not just to traffic, but to traffic in a commercial quantity of the drug. Now, if you think about it, that creates a situation where someone, we'll call him Mr. Drug Trafficker, he turns up at work on day one going, wonder what I'll do today. Okay, I'm a drug trafficker, I might traffic drugs. Fine, 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 all day, sell, sell, sell. Go home, go to bed, wake up the next day, what am I going to do? That's right, I'm a drug trafficker, go back to work and do it again. Do it every single day to his heart's content, possibly over a period of time during which the police observe him, traffic an amount vastly in excess of the designated commercial quantity for the drug. However, because this was effectively a day-to-day matter and that the prosecution can't establish that when he first turned up to work on the first day of this duretti count, on the 1st of January, he sat down and thought, you know what, I intend to traffic more than the commercial quantity over the next however long. If the prosecution can't prove that, no matter how much he's trafficked over that time, they can't prove the commercial quantity count against him. And you think about how that might affect things. You would think the person trafficking as a business is precisely the target of Confiscation Act type orders. This is exactly the sort of person that one would think the laws are aimed at, the person who is making money day in and day out and accumulating assets on the basis of that business. As a result of Mustika, it's become extraordinarily hard now to link that person with the commercial quantity offence that would then make it an automatic forfeiture issue for the prosecution. Now, that's created a huge difficulty, I'd submit, for the Crown, because you think what their choice is now. They can either roll the dice on a commercial quantity charge, hoping that it can be inferred that there was an intention from day one, or simply take the trafficking simpliciter charge, forget about the Confiscation Act consequences and just hope that the judge will take into account that whilst it's only trafficking simpliciter, it's trafficking in a vast amount of drugs over that period and he should be sentenced accordingly. Or a third alternative that might not be necessarily too palatable for an accused. If you think about it, a duretti count is really a matter of convenience. It's putting together a whole bunch of separate transactions into one charge. One alternative for the Crown might be that, well, instead of charging you with one duretti count, we charge you in relation to each and every transaction over a period of time. Now, one of the challenges that may come up for defence counsel is, would you rather plead guilty to one charge of trafficking in a commercial quantity that you may well have a defence to on the basis they can't prove the intent, or plead guilty to 70 separate trafficking charges, all individually carrying 15 years maximum imprisonment. Now, I suspect that's going to be a call to make on a case-by-case basis. There may well be some cases where you think, well, to be honest, the outcome's going to be better if we wear a charge that we may necessarily have a conviction to, as opposed to the alternative, which might be particularly unpalatable. But ever since Mustika, that's the challenge that's faced both the Crown and the defence. Now, I'll be quick. Now, there's two other cases I've drawn your attention to. It makes my observations as to where the law's at the moment. The first one I put in, apart from any other reason, it's really entertaining, and that's the case of Waters versus the Queen. Now, if you want to draw something out of Waters, it's the fact that precision in the way the Crown put their case and from a defence perspective, demanding that precision is so important. You need to be aware as to precisely what transactions and or what other type of conduct relates to what particular charge. The second thing you want to take out of Waters is it's really, really good now that they name the County Court judges who've been appealed against. That's that makes it so much more entertaining. Now, in Waters, that was a situation where the Crown, and I'll paraphrase this a bit and add a bit of my own interpretation. The Crown started with a case that was put on a certain basis. The judge formed a view fairly early that the prosecutor had perhaps not prepared it as closely as he might have, and the judge very helpfully pointed out for the prosecution a number of different and better ways that he might be able to put the case. Now, what emerged from there is that, and you can follow it in the case, the basically day in and day out, the judge has found more and better ways to put the charges against the accused, and that the accused, Mr. Waters, was facing a moving feast day in and day out. Ultimately, the judge succeeded in his purpose of getting Mr. Waters convicted and gave him an absolutely enormous sentence. But as a result of this lack of clarity, well, the community's got to pay for that all to be done again. Now, really, as an observation, I say this, there has to be real precision about the way a case is put. Is it put based on possession for sale? If so, what drugs, how much, when and where? Is it put on the basis of actual sales? In which case, identify them, identify the evidence that relates to them. Is it put on a offer for sale basis? And in which case, identify which phone calls are relied upon, what it's said to be. Now, that's very important because, especially in cases where they're relying upon telephone intercepts, as so many of them do now, it's very difficult reading telephone intercept material because people don't talk with complete precision. Transactions get mixed up. The same transaction will be referred to two and three times. One matter might be mentioned once and then didn't come through and drops off again. If the prosecution are going to be alleging that these matters add up to a commercial quantity, I say that especially when they're part of the element of the offence is proving that the trafficking was over was in a particular volume, precision in the way the Crown put their case is an absolute prerequisite. Now, the other case I mention is Momcilovic. Now, Momcilovic has been noted for a number of different reasons. Can I say I'll strip back all the material about the charter and all this kind of stuff, and I really think there's one aspect from a practical perspective in relation to drug trials to take out of Momcilovic. That is that since Momcilovic, Section 5 of the Drugs, Poisons and Controlled Substances Act, the deeming provision does not apply when the prosecution are attempting to prove a charge of trafficking. Now, the situation before was that if you had drugs found on your premises of which you were an occupier, you were deemed to be in possession unless you were able to establish on the evidence, on the balance of probabilities, something to the contrary. Now, what that meant in relation to trafficking charges was that for a trafficking charge that was reliant upon possession for the purposes of sale, essentially one of the key aspects of the Crown case, namely possession, didn't have to be established by the Crown beyond reasonable doubt. basically the Crown could establish the possession on the basis that the accused failed to convince us otherwise. Now, since Momcilovic, that's not the case. Where there is a trafficking charge put on the basis that drugs found in someone's home or in premises in which they occupy is an element of the offence, the prosecution have to prove possession and possession for sale beyond reasonable doubt. They can't rely on Section 5, the deeming provision. And you might think that's a fair enough decision. It would seem to be somewhat perverse that somebody could get convicted of trafficking, as indeed Ms. Momcilovic was, in circumstances where a key aspect of the case is not established beyond reasonable doubt. That seems somewhat counterintuitive. It hasn't been fixed up legislatively yet, so at the moment that's the way that the law applies. But be aware that since Momcilovic, the deeming provision applies to possession, but it doesn't apply to trafficking offences. Now, my final observation was just an observation about the running of these drug trials. As I say, most drug trials are circumstantial matters, and in those circumstances, in relation to most drug trials, police officers and the informant, despite the fact they may well be the main witnesses in the matter, they're generally fairly irrelevant to the guilt or otherwise of your client. They're generally not witnesses whose position in the trial is particularly important. More often than not, they are there in a functional capacity, namely, they're the vehicle through which the interview is going to be tendered, the telephone intercepts are going to be tendered, any other exhibits are going to be tendered. Bearing that in mind, as tempting as it is on occasions, if you think that a police officer has a particular view of your client that is not supported by the evidence, attempting to point that out to the police officer in court and attempting to make them and their opinion of some significance in the course of the trial is generally a complete waste of time. And generally, it runs the risk of forensically the matter not working out as well for your client as you might hope. Be aware before you go down that path that police officers have probably got information beyond that presented in the trial, and that on a human level they're much, much more emotionally invested in the outcome of this trial than you will ever be, and as such the likelihood of them conceding ground, especially upon points of opinion about the strength of their case, is absolutely minimal. My view is that where you can make the police officer irrelevant, they're, if given the opportunity, they will take it to enhance the perceived credibility of their case. But generally speaking, if you look at it in pure evidentiary terms, they haven't got much to contribute. And generally speaking, if you keep it that way, that's in your client's best interests. Now, ladies and gentlemen, thanks for listening. This is obviously an extremely broad topic. I've tried to just cherry pick a few small aspects of it, but I think what we can say is that as we stand here in 2012, the drug trials have evolved into a very distinctive beast where things aren't always as they seem. There are significant consequences for an accused depending on what charge they're convicted of, even if their conviction on a charge might be absolutely inevitable. It's very rare now that somebody comes to you in relation to a drug charge and, to be honest, there's not much you can do for them, there's not much you can explore. Generally speaking, the way the laws emerged, there's been opportunities created to save time in custody, perhaps save them from custody, and certainly save their assets. And being aware of that, I think, is going to be of great benefit to your clients. Thanks very much.